All right, we are back in Exodus, Exodus 11. We're going to hit the last plague tonight and go from there and just see the Passover and the Exodus from Israel. And finally, we'll see if we get there, but I'm hoping to get all the way to the Song of Moses in chapter 15. And as we've been obviously walking through Exodus, we've seen how in the first nine plagues and really through this whole section that God's desire was really to define who he was and show who he was to the people of Israel, and even more than that, to the Egyptians, and ultimately to the whole world. And we saw that phrase, you know, that you may know, or that they may know, that just runs throughout here, where, you know, God is really defining and revealing who he is by the Exodus. And obviously by that he's a saving God, that he's a powerful God. That gets to the core of who he is. These are not just kind of ancillary attributes of God, kind of on the side, you know, like, oh, Kirk has brown hair. You know, it's more like at the essence of who you are and defines your character. And that's why that whole section about, you know, by my name Yahweh, I have not been revealed to the forefathers, which, you know, in many senses was such a problematic passage even for me and a lot of commentators. But when you recognize that it's that same word know, you know, there, that runs throughout this whole section, it ties that together, at least in my mind, makes it clear that this is what he's doing. He's revealing what it means that he's Yahweh. He's revealing who he truly is. And as we come to Exodus 11 and the 10th plague, really, we've kind of reached the climax. And we talked about how the first three were in groups of three. And so, you know, 3, 6, 9, you have three groups of three. And now the 10th plague, really everything's been building to here. Everything in one sense is only just a precursor to the last plague. And obviously, just in terms of the amount of text that's devoted to it, as well as the significance of it, obviously by the fact that it is what causes them to be released from Egypt, everything goes to this last plague. And then the significance upon that is also just drawn out in the Passover and the Feast of the Unleavened Bread, and the parting of the Red Sea, and the kind of the narrative that follows. This is really the pinnacle of it. And so as we come here, we obviously just want to focus on and meditate on what God is revealing about himself here. And it really is the same, just there's a continuity between the first nine, but then this really is the apex of it. Also, as we looked at the first nine plagues, we just to kind of review a little bit, we talked about how they seemed to be directed at least to some degree against the gods of Egypt, and that's also potentially true for the 10th, whether it be they had a very strong belief that basically Pharaoh was a god and that he received that because he was the son of Ra. And so, like, the firstborn son, he was the heir. And so that whole idea, the firstborn son being a god, you know, to have the firstborn son killed seems to hit right at the heart of that. It also may play in, they had a god of death, and maybe it plays in with there that ultimately Yahweh's the one that's sovereign over death rather than their gods. But ultimately, the big picture is God's powerful. God's the one that's in control. And we could see that just from all these plagues. Also, the other thing I was going to mention with this last plague is there seems to be a divine sense of retribution, that what God does is just. In other words, that they're even deserving of this to some degree because of, you go all the way back to the beginning, what did they do to the Israelites? They tried to kill all their sons. You know, so there seems to be somewhat of a sense of God doing what is just. And even in the, I think that's even mentioned, if I remember correctly. I don't know if I'm going to be able to find it. But if my memory serves me, God even brings out that connection where he talks about the fact that, you know, Israel is my firstborn son. And just that contrast between whose firstborn son is it? And so that seems to be brought out in the text. See, was there anything else before we dive in just to review any, I don't know, does that seem to flow? Does that make sense in terms of where we're at and where we're going? All right. Well, I think then we could dive in. So, Exodus chapter 11. Now, Yahweh said to Moses, "One more plague I will bring on Pharaoh and on Egypt. After that, he will let you go from here. When he lets you go, he will surely drive you out from here completely. Speak now in the hearing of the people that each man ask from his neighbor and each woman from her neighbor for articles of silver and articles of gold." Yahweh gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Furthermore, the man Moses himself was greatly esteemed in the land of Egypt, both in the sight of Pharaoh's servants and in the sight of the people. Moses said, "Thus says Yahweh, about midnight I am going out into the midst of Egypt, and all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of the Pharaoh who sits on his throne, even to the firstborn of the slave girl who is behind the millstones, all the firstborn of the cattle as well. Moreover, there shall be a great cry in all the land of Egypt, such as there has not been before, and such as never be again. But against any of the sons of Israel, a dog will not even bark, whether against man or beast." And then once again, here's this phrase, "that you may know that Yahweh makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. All these your servants will come down to me and bow themselves before me, saying, 'Go out, you and all the people who follow you, and after that I will go out.' And he went out from Pharaoh in hot anger. Then Yahweh said to Moses, 'Pharaoh will not listen to you, so that my wonders will be multiplied in the land of Egypt.' Moses and Aaron performed all these wonders before Pharaoh, yet Yahweh hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the sons of Israel go out of his land." So there we have, obviously, the introduction to the plague here. And so, just a couple things to note. First of all, as we start off, obviously, it's in one sense, as we walk through this narrative, if you can even go back to Genesis and see that this was foretold, in a sense. And so, you see that really this is the pinnacle. And even as you come here, you know, all the other plagues, it's like, I'm going to do this, and they just kind of build. But then you get to verse 1 of chapter 11, it's one more plague. And so, you know, I guess just even the prophecy, the prophetic nature of this shows that, okay, God's been working here. And so it's like all the other ones are moving on to something else. But this one, he's like, okay, this is the last one. This is what I've been getting to all along. And so here we are. After that, I'm going to bring you out. And obviously, once again, as we saw, God's purpose in this was to display his power, to display his salvation of his people, his redemption of his people from slavery, to make them a people to serve him. And so as he's been working all along towards this goal, here he is at the brink of it. And also it's just interesting as you come to verse 2 and 3, how the Israelites basically plunder the Egyptians. I think it really probably, in my mind, you know, you ask the question, well, why is that put in there? What does that show? What's the significance of the fact that these Israelites basically take all the silver and gold and all these possessions from these Egyptians? And I think it seems to me, as we've walked through Genesis, that it ties back to the idea of blessing upon the people of Israel. That obviously they are the descendants of Abraham. And we've seen all the way back in Exodus that, what, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, what happened? Their flocks multiplied, their gold and their silver. They just, everything that they did was blessed. And I think here you see this very same idea that this is God's chosen people. And so even something that's kind of, in one sense, unheard of or ridiculous or why in the world would they do that? It just shows God's favor and God's blessing upon his people. And that's, you know, what verse 3 clearly says, right? Yahweh gave the people favor, right? This is because of God's favor, because of God's blessing. They're his chosen people. And so he is going to redeem them from slavery to serve and worship him. And in the process, of course, everything that they do, he blesses. And so this is just another example of that. And so, obviously, there's the statement that all the firstborn are going to die. And notice verse 6. And verse 6 is something that also brings out this idea that I mentioned earlier of this divine retribution. There's a number of things within this section that seems to point back to earlier parts in the narrative, and this is one of them, this idea that there shall be a great cry in all the land of Egypt. Does that sound familiar? You know, it's the same term that's used earlier in the book about the Israelites crying out. And that term is, I don't remember how many times it's used earlier in the book about the Israelite, but they cry out to God because of their affliction and their toil and their suffering, right? And so now there's this aspect that they're getting what they deserve. And you see that all throughout the Old Testament where you'd call it almost like tit-for-tat kind of retribution theology. And it's not to say that God's vindictive, but I think the reason that the authors bring out that parallel connection there is to show God's justice. In other words, this is what they did, so this is what they get. It matches, and it shows that God is just, and that his punishment, it doesn't go beyond, but it's in line with and consistent with the crime that was done. And so I think the author's trying to bring out some of those parallels between what the Egyptians did in oppressing the Israelites and show that that same thing comes back to them to point out God's justice in bringing out this retribution. Because you look at the Exodus story, and I guess in one sense, you know, it's such a Sunday school story for us, but there could be a sense in which you could almost read it and feel sorry for the Egyptians. I mean, they get pretty beat up through the process, and you could almost say, well, it was just Pharaoh, and how come, you know, the whole land had to suffer? But I think part of this really goes to show, and we know that God is just, but the author is trying to emphasize and show that God is just even through the way he tells the story. And so once again, it points out that even something, and of course we'll get to, you know, a long time later, we'll get to the conquest eventually when we get to Joshua, right? And they're going to wipe out all these Canaanites. And once again, there's a big emphasis made there that, you know, this is what they deserved. It goes all the way back to Genesis that the wickedness of the Canaanites was great. And so, anyway, I think that those parallel terms that kind of bring us back to earlier in the narrative really show that God is just, he's righteous in what he's doing and bringing this judgment. Of course, he has a plan for it all. Of course, he's the one that's sovereign, and of course, he's the one that hardened Pharaoh's heart, right? It keeps bringing it back to his plan, that this is all part of his plan to display his character and his might and his grace. But at the same time, it also shows that Pharaoh himself is guilty. And at the same time, it also shows that the Egyptians are getting what they deserve. So as we see, you kind of have that dual line emphasis there. That on the one hand, God is sovereign. He's planned this all out. He's the one that's doing it to display his glory, to make himself known, to exalt his character and his awesome power and his great salvation. But at the same time, what he's doing is just. And it's not something that they didn't deserve. In fact, it's exactly what they did to the Israelites, what's being done back to them. And so you want to kind of, in one sense, I guess, keep those things in tension. Because it'd be easy to look at it and be like, oh, God is this puppet master or chess player, and he's moving all the pieces and he's making everything happen. Oh, these poor people. You know, all these poor Egyptians that, like, God's just, like, controlling their hearts and, you know, and, oh, you know, but this is really showing, hey, look, this is what they did to the Israelites. This is, you know, they were killing Israel's firstborn sons, you know, and so this is coming back on them. So anyway, I just wanted to bring that out because it really, I think, is a major corrective to a wrong idea that we can have about God, that when there's such an emphasis on his sovereignty, to forget about the fact that he's always just and he's not bringing out unjust retribution on people just like, oh, too bad for you, you know, I'm going to wipe you out and, you know, all this stuff and forget that, oh no, he's actually doing what is righteous and what is just in the midst of all of it. So that is why I think there's an emphasis on that in the text. All right, I think that pretty much covers, you know, most of chapter 11 there, just in the introduction to the Exodus and the Passover. Obviously, once again, you know, verse 9 just gets to the purpose in chapter 11. Then Yahweh said to Moses, Pharaoh will not listen to you, so that my wonders will be multiplied in the land of Egypt. And that's just what we've been saying all along, right? His desire to show how powerful he is, to show how awesome he is, so that he can make his name great and really reveal his character, which up until this point in progressive revelation had never been revealed to this kind of a degree, who God was. It's kind of a crazy thought because I mean, we're so used, we have all of God's revelation. But just imagine that up until this point in history, you know, people didn't, I guess they should have known to some degree that God is awesome and powerful and God's a saving God. But, you know, we take for granted how much revelation we have. And just especially imagining that this is the first book of the Bible that was written, you know. And so, you know, just imagine how much this would have advanced their understanding of who God is to see his character displayed in the Exodus like this. And so it's easy for us to take for granted because we know so much about who God is to forget how much this really, especially to them, revealed about who God is. It's a pretty awesome thought to think about. Now, that brings us to chapter 12. And chapter 12 is, you know, a lot of regulations and different laws and things about the Exodus. And it would be easy to kind of see this as, I don't know, maybe an aside. Oh, here's a bunch of rules and regulations. Get us back to the story, you know, get us back to the narrative. Why are we interjecting, you know, all these different things? And there's a number of different reasons, but I think primarily there's a lot here that emphasizes the importance of the Exodus. And really what is taking place in this last plague. So obviously chapter 12 is going to deal largely with the Passover. And so it's, I guess I'll put it this way, just to kind of summarize. It's not just that God redeemed his people out of slavery. It's not just that they were in slavery and God brought them out and formed them into a nation. That's, of course, true, and that's a major emphasis, that God brought them out from serving Pharaoh to serve him. He redeemed the worshiping people. But what's brought about in this 10th plague is even a bigger idea than that. And that's really the idea that God has saved them from death. That's the whole idea of the firstborn here. It's the, and you could even probably go, I don't want to go too far with this idea, but I mean, a lot of people, you know, the whole idea of redemption, I'll just put it that way, is really introduced here for the first time. They're redeemed from, you know, how broad do you want to make it? Certainly from the idea of death and the death angel, you know, and the death of the firstborn. You know, you could even maybe broaden a little bit the whole idea of sin and death that they're redeemed from and God owns them. And obviously that concept of redemption is a major theological theme that runs throughout the whole Old Testament that really receives its definition here. And so this whole idea of the Passover, at this point, it broadens just from God saved the people from slavery. Really, God has saved them from death. And they owe God their lives and their worship and who they are because of the Passover event. And it's the whole idea, too, that God saved them, you know, once again, not just from slavery, but the whole idea of, obviously, the blood on the doorposts.
Top of the door frame.
That's right. And so, obviously, just the whole idea there is the idea of even of substitution, which is brought in, obviously, killing a lamb and the lamb standing in the place of them dying. The whole sacrificial system is going to be based on that idea of substitution. So really here, with this whole idea of the Passover, major theological themes are introduced, which flow throughout the whole rest of Scripture and are going to be expanded upon ultimately until you get to Christ and his death on the cross. But just those key thoughts of redemption, and deliverance and salvation. This is kind of, and that's why I would say that here God revealed himself in a way that he had never revealed himself to such a degree before. You know, and that's why this Exodus event becomes so significant. That's why so much text is devoted to it. That's why, you know, this is so significant that, as we'll see, verse 2, you know, this month shall be the beginning of months for you. Is be the first month of the year to you. They're going to redefine their whole calendar based on this event. Right? That it's supposed to so imbibe their consciousness and just change the way that they think about everything, that their whole year, the calendar, you know, all of a sudden it's like if I were to say, okay, March 10th is now going to be January 1st. And we're going to redo our whole calendar, you know, so that that's the first day of the year, you know, and we're going to set up a whole celebration just surrounding it. Obviously, that's going to change the whole consciousness of everything that you think about. And it shows how important this is to all of their life. Hey, welcome. We're in Exodus. We're walking through the Passover, and so Exodus 12. So anyway, as you walk through here, obviously, we're not going to necessarily read everything throughout this whole section. There's a lot of specific instructions in Exodus 12 that God gives them about how they are to do this or that or the other. And there is a large emphasis on their exact obedience to all the commandments of the Lord. And obviously that has a lot to do with going back to who this was written to. Obviously written to the Exodus, not the Exodus generation, the generation about to go into the promised land for the conquest. And so God really emphasizes their specific obedience as an example to those, the obedience of this Exodus generation as an example to those who are about to go into the conquest. And of course, the point is you need to be very careful in obeying God to the T, just like these people did. So there's a lot of regulations that are done there. And once again, there's a whole feast, and there's a lot of ceremony, I guess we should say, with it as well. And the purpose of that is to, as we said, to so transform their thinking that this event becomes central to all that they do. You know, and so they're going to have a whole feast and a festival and Passover and the weeks, and everything that goes with it is so that they will remember and not forget. Because obviously in subsequent generations, and this is made explicit in the text, subsequent generations don't experience the Exodus like this generation does, right? They weren't there and hear the wailing of the Egyptians, right? They didn't see the Red Sea part and walk through the Red Sea and see it close in on everyone else. You know, that, like we said, that moment defines Israel as a nation and God as the God of his people. It defines them. And so subsequent generations need to be reminded. Subsequent generations need to have that impressed upon their thinking and their consciousness that that's who we are, is we are a redeemed people. We are a people who have been redeemed from slavery, and even more so, redeemed from death, as we talked about with the death angel. Of course, we should give our lives to serve and worship and obey Yahweh. You know, and they need that constantly imbibed upon their consciousness. And so that is why the ceremony and the redefinition of the calendar year and all the specific regulations are to cause this to be in their thinking, right? To transform the way they think and cause them to focus on what they should focus on, right? And so, you know, there's going to be, you just go through it and we could, you know a lot, you know about so many of these different things and the different regulations. I don't necessarily need to go through all of it with us, but I'd say that's the purpose of it there. All right, any questions? I do want to point out a couple things in terms of specifics in these chapters, but I'll pause there for either some questions or if there's need for clarification.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Like same idea, maybe not exactly the same, but the idea here of the Passover to be this defining moment where, you know, it is to define lifestyle. You know, it kind of speaks to him.
Yeah, for sure.
In a small bit.
Yeah, and I mean, it's even good. I mean, just some application from there is how easy it is for all of us to forget, you know, and just even Christmas, as you mentioned, you know, we're coming into the Christmas season. How much do we lose focus about what it's supposed to be about? And so, you know, God went through and said, okay, this is what I want you to do. I want you to kill a lamb. You know, it should remind you of like, oh, this lamb is taking my place. There's substitution. I've been redeemed. And you do all these things to, oh, yeah, I remember. We used to be in bondage in Egypt. You know, oh, yeah, and you know, and all these things to remind us. And you know, if you do this, hopefully that will remind you enough to, like, you should cause you to feel like you're supposed to feel. And like, oh yeah, I have been saved. I have been redeemed, ransomed from slavery and death. I have been redeemed to serve Yahweh rather than serving Pharaoh. I should live this kind of life. Right? It's very Romans 12-esque, you know? Since you have, you know, therefore live this way, right? You are no longer yours. God, you have been bought with a price, so therefore honor God with your body and live life of worship and service to God. And so that is what we see throughout this section. And I just kind of point out a couple other statements here. Go ahead and look at verse 12 of chapter 12. For I will go through the land of Egypt on that night, and I will strike down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am Yahweh. So we had mentioned that a couple times, the idea that these plagues are against the gods, and I wouldn't necessarily, once again, make a direct correspondence one-to-one, but this verse makes it pretty explicit here that does seem to be the point of a lot of the Exodus, is to show that Yahweh is the only true God. There are no other gods. He's executing judgment on those gods. And so I think this verse brings a lot of definition to at least one of the purposes that God was accomplishing in the Exodus. And so as we see here, they eat the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And once again, because verse 17, therefore you shall observe this day throughout your generations as a permanent ordinance. Right? Once again, this has very much of this has in mind not the current generation, but subsequent generations. A lot of these instructions weren't necessarily for them, but for other people who wouldn't remember, who didn't go through the Exodus, who didn't see God's mighty hand and His power and His salvation, so that they will remember. We mentioned that before, but I wanted to show you it from the text. Let me just say, too, the whole idea of Passover, it's a little bit of a question what even that word means in Hebrew. One of the options is the idea of passing over something, and that's kind of the traditional understanding, but it may even have more of an idea of salvation or showing mercy. It's a really rare word, so I would like to do more study on it, but we don't have a whole lot of, you know, examples of this word to be able to study it. But the whole idea of the Passover may be even a richer word than just the idea of passing over, like, you know, death passing by. It may have more the idea of God's salvation and His mercy, which is a pretty cool statement, because if you look at verse 23, for example, you know, then Yahweh will pass through to smite the Egyptians. When He sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, Yahweh will, and then this is the verb of from which we get the idea of passing over. It could be the idea of Yahweh will save, or Yahweh will show mercy. It could have, you know, more just a limited idea of passing over, but it may be, you know, once again, it's a rare word, but it may be a richer idea than this. You know, God's compassion and His mercy on His people. And once again, that event, the Passover, as we've seen throughout here, is really intended to define who God is. And as we mentioned it already, but I'll keep mentioning, the whole purpose of this is that refrain that keeps running through here, that they will know that I am Yahweh, that they will know who I am. It defines His character. And that's, you know, He says it again, verse 24, you shall observe this event as an ordinance for you and your children forever. Right? When you enter the land, you know, you shall observe this rite. And when your children say to you, what does this rite mean? You shall say, is the Passover, who, once again, this verb, passed over, saved. And so, He smote the Egyptians, but spared our homes, and the people bowed low and worshipped. And that's a pretty cool statement, because that was the whole purpose, as we've said, of the Exodus. God saved them, He redeemed them from, once again, that key word, from serving Pharaoh, to serve Yahweh. And so what are they doing here? They're serving and worshiping Yahweh. They have been redeemed to be a worshiping people. That's so much of the point. And so as a result of God's salvation, as a result of God's redemption, they worship Him. And that's how it's supposed to be. Right? And that's how it's supposed to be for us. Because God has saved us, because He's redeemed us, we should live lives of worship. We should live lives of service. And don't separate those two terms. Service and worship are integrally linked, especially in Exodus. You know, really the two words are interchangeable. A life of worship is a life of service, and vice versa. that to serve, to work for God is to worship Him, and those two, and you can't get the idea of worship apart from service. You know, you can't separate those two ideas in the Old Testament. We can separate them in our minds, but in their thinking, they go together. And so, verse 28, they went and did what God said. And once again, just an emphasis on their obedience. Welcome. And so, once again, I think that's for subsequent generations to see the exact obedience that the people had as an example to them. Well, let's continue on. And so, verse 30, there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was no home where there was not someone dead. And obviously, talked about how the fact that the firstborn, just that divine retribution and that cry that the Israelites cried out a great cry earlier in the book, now the Egyptians are crying out a great cry. It's God's justice. And once again, they killed the sons of Israel, so now God is killing their sons. And so, verse 33, they say, get out of here, you know, and so basically, everyone leaves. You know how it goes. They plunder the Egyptians, and verse 37, they journeyed 600,000 men on foot, aside from Jonah. That's like 2 million people. That's an awesome event that God brings about here. And also, there's this interesting little verse here, verse 38, a mixed multitude also went up with them. The question is, okay, who's this mixed multitude?
Flocks and herds.
Well, it does include flocks and herds, but it's the mixed multitude is people. And the question is, who are these people? And seems to be Egyptians. And I wouldn't make too much out of it, except for the fact that throughout the whole Pentateuch, as we've been walking through it, there's such an emphasis that God's salvation is global and it's for the peoples. And there's, if you read through here, and we're not, like I said, we're not going to read the whole text that we're going over tonight word for word, but there's this emphasis that even the foreigner who's among you, if he's circumcised, if he becomes a part of the people of Israel, he enters into a covenant relationship with God, he can be in a right relationship with God as well. And so, yes, there's, on one hand, this religion, if I'm going to call it that, this relationship with Yahweh is very exclusive. It's only through Israel, whom is God's chosen people, and through His singular means of salvation, which is entering into relationship with Him. But it's also very broad in its scope. The ideal in the Old Testament was that the whole world would be in a right relationship with Yahweh by basically uniting with Israel. And Israel would have been at the center of God's plan for the world. And we've seen that run throughout the whole Pentateuch, that theme. And we'll see it, well, eventually when we get to Deuteronomy, and we see that theme running through there over and over again, that God's plan is to bless the world, to bless the nations. And so when you bring in this idea of a mixed multitude, it's the idea of foreigners, and foreigners can too be in a right relationship with Yahweh if they go through God's appointed means. And I know that's bringing a lot into this verse, but you have to, you know, you've seen so much of Genesis that already, and Deuteronomy, that theme running through here. And the idea that the foreigner, you know, can be circumcised and partake of the Passover, you know, that's, if you read through the regulations in these chapters, you'll see that the foreigner can partake of it as well. And once again, it's because God's plan for salvation is global. It's not just limited. Yes, Israel is His chosen people, but in one sense, it's not limited to them. It was designed to go beyond that and for His salvation to reach the world. And so you see even a glimpse of it here with this quote-unquote mixed multitude, you know, of Egyptians and just foreigners who went out with Israel. And so at the end of 430 years to the very day, all the hosts of Yahweh went out from the land of Egypt. Awesome statement. 2 million people up and left just by God's mighty power. It is a night to be observed for Yahweh, having brought out from the land of Egypt. This night is Yahweh's, to be observed by all the sons of Israel throughout their generations. Verse 42. Continue on. Where is it? Yeah, see, verse 48. talks about verse 43 that no foreigner is to eat of it, but if you look to verse 48, but if a stranger sojourns with you and celebrates the Passover to Yahweh, let all his males be circumcised, and then let him come near to celebrate. And he shall be like a native of the land. But no uncircumcised person may eat of it. So it's very exclusive, and yet it's also very global in its scope. You have both aspects of it. And obviously that brings a lot, even a lot of that's applicable to the New Testament. Yes, there's only one way to God. It's through God's appointed means of salvation. And obviously in the New Testament days, it's through Christ. So it's very narrow in one sense, but it's also very global and very broad in its scope in another. One way, but yet it's designed to be global. So you see that so clearly from God's intent all the way from the beginning was to be global and yet at the same time to be through his appointed means. Alright, chapter 13, you know what happens. Now they talk about the consecration of the firstborn. I don't want to get too much into this, but this is what this chapter really gets into, the whole idea of redemption that we've talked about, that you know, because God spared the Israelites from their firstborn dying, it's once again, it's not just the idea that God redeemed them from slavery, it's the idea that God has redeemed them from death. Because the firstborn of everyone in Egypt died, and really, in one sense, the firstborn of Israel, the Israelites, should have died too. And so God spared them not just from slavery, but also from death. And so they are, therefore, to consecrate or to set apart their firstborn for Yahweh. And there's a lot of regulations about this, but it's just bringing in this key concept of redemption, that God has bought you. You know, you deserve to be dead. God spared you. You owe God your life. That's the thought. You know, that's, if you want to just boil it down to its most simple thought, that's what it is, and that's what we said. The whole rest of the Bible obviously builds upon that until you ultimately get to Christ, and the whole idea of a sacrificial system, and the firstborn, all these things really tie together. That God here is really defining and showing who he is as a saving God. What his salvation entails, it involves redemption. Him buying you and paying for something that you don't deserve. You deserve death and slavery. But God bought you and he redeemed you and he's yours and he has saved you. You know, and so therefore he owns your worship and your life, and you are to give everything to him. And that's what this whole section about the firstborn really brings about. Let me see if there's anything else in chapter 13 that we just want to highlight here. You know, once again, it's just the same thing. Verse 8, continue to tell your son. Once again, it's not for that generation, but it's as a remembrance, because the later generations won't have been through this. And just to impress this upon the national consciousness of the nation, you know, this is who we are. We are redeemed people. This is what God has done for us. Let's remember it. Let's celebrate this. Let's go through these rituals so that we'll remember who we are as a people. You know, verse 14, it shall come when your son asks you in time to come, saying, what is this? Then you shall say to him, with a powerful hand, Yahweh brought us out of Egypt from the house of slavery. And it came about when Pharaoh was stubborn about letting us go that Yahweh killed every firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of beast. Therefore, I sacrifice to Yahweh the males, the first offspring of every womb, but the firstborn of my sons I redeem. So it shall serve as a sign on your hand, and as, you know, basically, you know, phylacteries, that's probably not the best translation, on your forehead, for with a powerful hand Yahweh brought us out of Egypt. Okay, and so basically then it talks about, okay, what's going to happen next? God, as we come to verses 17 through 22, God is leading the people of Israel out of Egypt. He brings them, and they're on their way to the land of Canaan, but God decides not to bring them by the shortest possible route, which is the route by the Philistines. God says, hey, I don't want them to see war. They're not ready for that yet. So he takes them kind of the long route, and basically he kind of leads them what appears to be into a dead end, because he's desiring to, once again, harden Pharaoh's heart to display his mighty power. And so you'll see that in 14 in chapter 2. Tell the sons of Israel to turn back and camp before Pi-Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, you shall camp in front of Baal Zephon, opposite by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the sons of Israel, they are wandering aimlessly in the land, the wilderness has shut them in. Thus I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will chase after them, and I will be honored through Pharaoh and his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am Yahweh. Right? That's the purpose. We've seen that run throughout this whole section over and over again. God is sovereign because he wants to reveal who he is. He wants to be known that this is who he is, a powerful, saving God. And so he's going to, once again, harden Pharaoh's heart in his sovereignty because he wants to display what an awesome God that he is. And once again, it's not just so that Israel may know. We've seen that phrase run throughout here. It's not even just so that Israel's sons may know who Yahweh is, but even Egypt, right? So that the nations may know who Yahweh is, and they may see Israel's God. And so, once again, the king of Egypt, you know, is like, hey, you know, he was told the people have fled. He's like, what have I done? There was all my servants, and obviously God has hardened his heart. So he's like, all right, let's go get them. You know, I'm going to go, you know, chase after him. So he gets his chariots, and he took, you know, his 600 choice chariots and all the officers with him. And the Lord hardened his heart, and so he chases after them. And so verse 10, it's amazing, right? What do the people do? They were frightened, and they cried out to Yahweh. It's just, after all 10 plagues, right, they still didn't fully get it. And we're obviously, as we walk through the rest of the Pentateuch, we're going to see this over and over again, that they never got it. You know, it's so sad in one sense that God did all this to define who he was and to show who he was, but they didn't get it. They didn't remember. It wasn't impressed upon their mind who Yahweh was. I mean, he showed it. They should have gotten it. They should have understood, but they didn't. And they say to Moses, is it because there were no graves in Egypt? A little sarcasm, I think, huh? Ever wondered if there's sarcasm in the Bible? Well, there it is. In Egypt that you have taken away to die in the wilderness, why have you dealt with us in this way, bring us out of Egypt? You know, for it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians. Wow. That's a terrible statement that they make, but they make it nonetheless. But Moses said to the people, and this is awesome, do not fear. Stand by and see the salvation of Yahweh, which he will accomplish for you today. That's awesome. He's just like, watch. Do nothing. You don't have to do a thing. Just watch. Watch the salvation of Yahweh. Once again, that's what the Exodus is. It's God displaying salvation. And so that's what he does here in a powerful way. He's going to display his salvation. Yahweh will fight for you while you keep silent. It's like, shut up. God's going to fight. Just watch. You know? And so Yahweh said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Tell the sons of Israel to go forward. And that's kind of funny because Moses wasn't necessarily the one crying out. But I think as we walk through the Pentateuch, you see that there's such a close relationship between Moses and the people. And really, he is the mediator. Moses is the mediator for the people. He's the one that stands before God for the people, but he is both ways. On their behalf, but then also when God has, in one sense, a rebuke for the people, he comes to Moses. And so I don't necessarily think Moses was crying out to Yahweh complaining, but as he's the mediator, he's kind of the leader, he's the one that kind of stands for the people. And you see this unique relationship that Moses has with God throughout the Pentateuch. And we'll continue to watch this, that he's the one that intercedes for them. In one sense, really, I don't know if I'd go so far as to say he's a type of Christ, but he really, in a lot of ways, as the mediator that stands between God and the people, prefigures Christ. He's the one that he stands before God, and really even the text itself says, you know, you're going to be God to the people. You know, that's the idea of the mediators. Like, you go to me, and then you hear me, and I'll talk to you, and then you go to the people. And so God used Moses. Moses was one of the truly unique characters in all of biblical history. That unique relationship that he had with God. In fact, obviously later in the Pentateuch, it's going to say that he's talked with God face to face as a man with his friend. And it says no one before or since ever had that kind of relationship with God. Obviously Christ. But that's a unique thing that he would just go in and talk to God like a friend. You know, God talks to other people, but he reveals himself in visions. But Moses had this unique relationship with God as the mediator. And so I think that's part of why God says to him, you, why did you cry out? It's because he's the one that's standing for the people. And in the same way that Christ, you know, took our sins and was that mediator between us and God, there's a lot of similarities there in Moses' relationship of standing before the people. So once again, verse 17, as for me, behold, you know, it's obviously hold up your staff, and I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, they will go in after them, and I will be honored. And probably even better, I will be glorified. God is seeking to glorify himself through this Exodus and in displaying who he is. And once again, what's the statement? Then the Egyptians will know that I am Yahweh, when I am glorified through Pharaoh, through his chariots and his horsemen, right? That's God's purpose. And the angel of God who had been going before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them. And so it came behind them, and Moses stretches out his hand, and obviously you know what happens, right? The Red Sea parts. One of the most, once again, truly awesome events in all of biblical history. It's hard to even picture what that must have been like. It's just so awesome.
That would have been cool, but if you see a big old sea just part in half and like, see the Red Sea.
It would have been an awesome sight, no doubt. And you know what happens, right? The Israelites go through and God confuses the Egyptian army and their chariots, and their wheels either fall off or swerve or whatever they do, and they're kind of just thrown into mass confusion. And God says, verse 20, stretch out your hand. And he does. And Yahweh overthrew the Egyptians in the middle of the sea. Verse 27, the waters returned and covered over them. The entire army, not even one of them remained, but the sons of Israel walked on dry land through the midst of the sea. And the waters were like a wall on them on their right hand and on their left. Thus, what? Yahweh saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians. And Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. When Israel saw the great power which Yahweh had used against the Egyptians, once again, here's the result, right? The people feared Yahweh, they believed in Yahweh, and his servant Moses, right? That unique place that Moses had. That's the goal. That's the goal. When God redeems and saves in such a powerful way as he did then, and obviously by implication as he's done for us, what should be the result? Right? Worship, service, fear, belief. Right? And that should have been the result throughout all of Israel's history. They understood who Yahweh was. He defined himself as a powerful saving God. They believe in him. They trust in him. They worship him with their lives. And so they constantly seek to remind themselves of how great he is, that they'll live this way for the rest of their lives and throughout their generations. You know, that's the intended result. But we know that that's not how the story always worked out for Israel. One day we're glad that it will work out for them. But you know that that's not how. But that's how it should have been, in a sense. Obviously God's still on the throne and still working out his plan. But as you come now to chapter 15 briefly, we have Moses' song, the Song of the Sea, where it's once again, if we're to live lives of worship as a result of God's salvation, you know, very fitting that a song comes next, right? A song of worship and praise to God that just exalts God and praises him and worships him for what he has done in his great salvation. And so let's just read through here. And really, there's a major picture of God here as a warrior. And so Moses and the sons of Israel sang this song to Yahweh and said, I will sing to Yahweh, for he is highly exalted. The horse and its rider he has hurled into the sea. Yahweh is my strength and song. He has become my salvation. This is my God, and I will praise him. My father's God, and I will extol him. Yahweh is a warrior. Yahweh is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his armies he has cast into the sea, and the choicest of his officers are drowned in the Red Sea. The deeps covered them, they went down into the depths like a stone. Your right hand, O Yahweh, is majestic in power, and your right hand, O Yahweh, shatters the enemy. And in the greatness of your excellence, you overthrow those who rise up against you. You send forth your burning anger, and it consumes them as chaff. At the blast of your nostrils, the waters were piled up. The flowing waters stood up like a heap. The deeps were congealed in the heart of the sea. The enemy said, I will pursue, I will overtake, I will divide the spoil. My desire shall be gratified against them. I will draw out my sword, my hand will destroy them. You blew with your wind, the sea covered them, they sank like lead in the mighty waters. Who is you among the gods, O Yahweh? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in praises, working wonders? You stretched out your right hand, the earth swallowed them. In your loving kindness you have led the people whom you have redeemed. In your strength you have guided them to your holy habitation. The peoples have heard, they tremble. Anguish has gripped the inhabitants of Philistia. Then the chiefs of Edom were dismayed. The leaders of Moab trembling grips them, and the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. Terror and dread fall upon them. By the greatness of your arm they are motionless as stone. Until your people pass over, O Yahweh. Until the people pass over whom you have purchased. You will bring them and plant them in the mountain of your inheritance, the place, O Yahweh, which you have made for your dwelling, the sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands have established. Yahweh shall reign forever and ever. For the horses of Pharaoh with his chariots and his horsemen went into the sea, and Yahweh brought back the waters of the sea on them, but the sons of Israel walked on dry land through the midst of the sea. And so Miriam the prophetess took her timbrel, and the women after her, and dancing. And Miriam answered and said, sing to Yahweh, he is highly exalted. The horse and its rider is hurled into the sea. And so that's how we close. Just this exalted praise to God. And obviously his salvation and his redemption are two of the primary things that are praised here. And that's, as we've said throughout this whole narrative, what God sought to display about himself. That he's a saving God. He's a redeeming God. He's a powerful God. That he's saved by his mighty power. And therefore, the result should be a life of worship and service and belief and trust and obedience. And as we've seen throughout this section. So, awesome statement. And you see even throughout here, even the nations have heard God displaying himself globally through the Exodus. And obviously that ties in so well to the purpose of the Exodus. Through the purpose of the Pentateuch throughout, that God is a global God. But I know we kind of went quickly there. We're trying to cover a lot of ground as we walk through here. Don't want to get bogged down in it. But it's just, you think about the Exodus, hopefully that gives you a big picture of what God was doing. He was making himself known as the saving God that he is. And seeking to redeem a people so that they will be a people of worship. And hopefully as you just hear all those things, it should immediately kind of ring a bell and click a little bit about us, you know, that we have been redeemed by a mighty right hand, that God is still a saving God, maybe not in the same kind of physical, visible way, but God's salvation is no less great. And we have been redeemed and ransomed and saved to worship and to serve. And so the more that we embed this into our consciousness, that this is who we are. We are redeemed people. Constantly reminding ourselves, and even, you know, every Easter, you know, and every time we take communion, as we're going to do this Sunday, just a constant reminder that this is who God is, so that we will live the kind of lives that we should, live lives of belief and trust, and constantly reminded by who our God is. And that's what he was seeking to do. But throughout this whole thing, his sovereign plan, he planned it all out, he worked it all out. He hardened Pharaoh's heart because he wanted to display who he was so that everyone would know. And that phrase that I should have counted how many times, but over and over through these 10 plagues, and it's just that you may know, that the Egyptians may know, that your children may know, God was making himself known. And so that's who our God is. All right, any questions or comments about that? Applications, how that resonates with your own hearts as you just meditate on how awesome God is and what he has done in salvation and redemption.
this is huge. Like, I just got back from Dearborn, working with a whole bunch of Muslims, and just learned a lot about what they believe. Talked with some imams, some leaders in the mosques there. It's just so different. So different. And like the promises that we have here, and just the picture that God is setting up, it's just precious and it's unique. Just the idea here that God's focus is redemption and salvation. It's not, here's a bunch of rules for you to follow so that you can do the best you can, and then when you come before me in judgment, like, depending on how merciful I'm feeling at the time, like, that's how you'll be judged. He says, no, put the blood on the door. This is the standard by which, like, my mercy will be given or not. Like, they knew.
Yeah.
You know, this is it. And, like, that's just sweet to see, like, just God's care for his people, that he would make himself known to say, this is the standard by which I'm a judge. And my purpose is to show you that I am the one that saved you. And it's shown multiple times with the blood on the door and with the Red Sea as well. Like, you didn't do everything right to get out to... You didn't do everything right for me to split the Red Sea. You know, like, I am part of the Red Sea because I'm a merchant, because I wanted to. And like, I saved you, and it was my hand that did it. It wasn't yours. And like, I guess all of this is just accentuated by seeing just the beliefs in Islam and just how it's so counter to that. And so we have a precious message and an amazing promise. Yeah, so then just the response and worship and service.
Yeah, that's good. Or anything else? Well, plenty there for us to meditate on. If there's nothing else, I'll close us in prayer and we can continue to talk about these things and meditate on them as we go from here.
Let me pray.
Our Father, as we do meditate on who you are, we first of all, we thank you that you have revealed yourself, that you have not kept silent, but you desire to manifest your character and your purpose and your plan. This was all your design to show who you were and to glorify yourself through the Egyptians and through Pharaoh, to show yourself as a powerful, mighty, saving God. And even as Ryan was sharing, we know that you are so different than all the false gods that are out there. And even here we see how you defeated all the false gods and showed how you are more powerful than any of the quote-unquote gods of the Egyptians. Because you want to show that you are the creator God, the global God of the universe, who demands worship and praise. And we do thank you as well for your salvation and your redemption. Just an awesome thought that you are a saving God and redeeming God, that you own us because you have saved us and redeemed us from death. We come before you and we want to apply these truths. We never want to forget them. We want to live as redeemed people. We want to constantly be reminded and not forget, as the Israelites so often did, to live lives of trust and belief and obedience and faith. to live lives of worship and service and gratitude. Lord, this is the only possible response that we could have to who you are and what you have done. Lord, we also want to be about your plan for the nations. We see it so clearly working out in the Pentateuch that you are a global God and you desire global worship. We see even glimpses of that here, and we see larger pictures of it throughout this book. So we pray that we would be about your plan and purpose, that as we do serve and worship you, that you would define that for us, and we would be about the proclamation of your singular message. And even here we saw the exclusivity of worship and relationship with you, but also the global nature of your salvation. So we thank you for these things. We thank you for the privilege of being able to participate with you in your plan. And we pray that you would use us powerfully to bring glory to your Son. Pray these things in his name. Amen.